Chapter 10. 11:30 GMT. COBRA meetings were the procedural heart of the English federal government's emergency management strategy, the name inherited from the British predecessor. The latest took place in a small, cluttered conference room in Government House. The Home Secretary chaired, with the Prime Minister listening in from an aircraft en route from London. There were more virtual attendees than those in the flesh. Tash recognised cabinet ministers, senior police officers, the chief scientific advisor, the chief medical officer with a representative of WHO Care, the Global Health Service, high-ranking military and others. Among the group was a disconcerting hologram of the Astronomer Royal, sent from the Skythrust. She seemed to be sitting in a bizarre lounge, with a decor apparently modelled on huge bottles, large, small, cut open, distorted, Dali-esque. If Charlie Marlowe was there, Mel must be just out of shot, Tash realised. All the main attendees were crowded around a small, smart table at the heart of the room. Remarkably small, it seemed to Tash, and remarkably cluttered with pads, pens, water bottles and glasses. Phones everywhere. Tash and other advisers sat back behind the main table, by the walls of the room, clustering behind the meeting member they supported, she and Grace for Fred Bowles, with others. Tash knew this room was dumber than it looked. Any electronic system could be hacked, so the room, and its many siblings in the buildings, had no fibres or cables going in or out, save for one heavily shielded emergency link. And it had basically been built into a Faraday cage that blocked electromagnetic radiation, radio signals. The participants, too, had been screened on their way in unobtrusively by a smart doorway. Minutes would be kept as the meeting began, with automated systems backed up for legal reasons by a human stenographer taking notes. The Home Secretary was Mara Kane, a tough and experienced ex-diplomat, very precisely spoken, with striking crew-cut black hair. She came from the right-wing half of England's governing coalition of the Democratic Greens and the English Reconstruction Party. Now she opened the meeting without preamble, saying they should summarise what was known. Which isn't much, as I've gathered from earlier meetings. The sun is missing, correct? That was a prompt for the Astronomer Royal's first contribution. Her voice filling the room. Charlie Marlowe confirmed that the sun had indeed, it seemed, gone. All of its mass, all of its fusing heart and roiling layers of hydrogen helium, and the heat and light it had been shedding across the solar system for over 4 billion years. We have multiple lines of evidence now to support that extraordinary claim. We have measured the deflection of our satellites and the inner planets to some extent arising from the loss of gravity. The sun is gone. And gone at the moment of eclipse totality, 0948 GMT, Marlowe said firmly. As I can confirm myself, having witnessed it. Kane leaned forward. Yes, my head is full of the emergency, the immediate details. But that itself is a very striking observation, isn't it? An eclipse is not a solar system-wide phenomenon, is it, Professor Marlowe? It is the casting of a shadow of the moon on the Earth. It happens at a specific moment, at a specific place. Well, totality lasts a few minutes if you're under the shadow. But for this disappearance to happen at the moment of eclipse here on Earth... I don't know how to finish this chain of thought. Fred Bowles nodded. Home Secretary, you are groping for a key insight, and I commend you. I think you mean that it's as if the event was linked to us, somehow. Us, humanity. Because on this planet, so far as we know, only humans understand eclipses. Kane raised her eyebrows. Astronomer Royal? I couldn't put it better myself, said Marlowe. Why have the event coincide with an eclipse if you didn't want to draw attention to the artificiality of it? Although I haven't got much further in my own speculation than that, not yet. Kane seemed to be trying to think that through. I wish you science bods would speak plainly. It's difficult to be plain if you aren't sure. Very well. but it seems to me that you are at least hinting that this phenomenon may not be entirely natural, that the sun hasn't just vanished of its own accord. We know of no natural mechanism that can make a star just vanish of its own accord, Marlowe said, or indeed any mechanism that could achieve such a feat. But we are a young species and have been observing the heavens scientifically for a very short time. But it could be natural, Kane said, plodding on, if the sun has fallen into another dimension, say. I've heard more ludicrous grant proposals, Marlowe said, not unkindly. Yes, it could be some kind of cosmic flaw, a natural phenomenon, beyond our current comprehension. Tash saw that Bowles was watching Marlowe closely. Bowles said now, But you don't think so, do you? Because of this coincidence with the eclipse, as you mentioned yourself, Home Secretary, which is a regular, well-understood occurrence. But such an eclipse would mean nothing without intelligent observers to see it. And only observers on this world. A Venusian might see our eclipse unfold, the geometry, but not the experience of the eclipse. Somebody, something, planned this, timed it to perfection, for our benefit, humans on Earth. You're very sharp, Mr. Bowles, Marlowe murmured. And you're quite right. Why, though? Marlowe shrugged. We are still in the middle of it. I have literally no idea. No sensible one, anyhow. Kane frowned. But look. If we are looking at some kind of intelligent extraterrestrial intervention here, haven't we thought about this? All those SETI chaps with their radio telescopes, looking for signals from the stars for nearly a century, Marlowe said. She sounded almost wistful, Tash thought. For the good old days when threats from intelligences in the sky were mere theoretical toys to play with. Right, Kane said. I know I'm new to this job, and an outsider too. Tash knew this was a line she played often. The Home Secretary was from the ERP, the English Reconstruction Party, a fairly radical group that advocated the reversal of British devolution, among other measures. A group which now found itself in coalition with Fred Bowles's limping Democratic Greens. So don't we have some kind of scenario pack prepared? As we do for a nuke attack or a pandemic or... No, Marlowe said. Those SETI chaps tried, Home Secretary, but always got laughed out of the room. But I don't think it makes much difference. I don't think anybody envisaged a situation like this. Kane sighed. Very well. The metaphysics can wait. What we need to do is review the practical actions we have taken and must take from now on here in England. Although this is clearly a global phenomenon. She glanced at a watch. I believe it is nearly dawn in New York City, she said dryly. I have observed that those on the night side of the planet when the cutting out occurred seem to have found it hard to credit the reality, despite the images of the darkness, the urgent calls, notably the Americans. Let us hope that when President-elect Cox wipes the sleep from her eyes, we will start putting together some kind of international response. I will be taking action points out of this meeting into an international forum which is being set up by the UN. Damn it, fizz, for later in the day. Tash recognised the slip. The old UN, enfeebled by the multiple crises of the 2030s and facing a swirl of changes among its membership, including secessions from such powerful nations as the US, Britain and Russia. Indeed, the US and Great Britain no longer existed as the entities they had once been, had more or less gracefully given way to a new body, the Federation of Independent States. This had been an era of global emergencies in which, paradoxically, states and regions had proved to be the principal managers of those emergencies. So the FIS, pronounced FIS, had inherited many of the old UN's functions, such as UNESCO and the Security Council, but it struck Tash as a somewhat less unwieldy body. A second draft of the UN without the deliberate mistakes, as Fred Bowles once said. That had been borne out, maybe, when it had efficiently supported the establishment of WHO care, an NHS for the world, as Tasha's dad had put it, and about bloody time. However, yes, Tash called it the UN sometimes too. Kane said, I know that the Foreign Secretary is holding relevant meetings in parallel with this one, but let's hear how we're getting on in England for now. So NHS representatives were invited to discuss the psychological impact of the loss of the son. Tash leaned forward, interested herself. They threw up a 2x2 chart. Fred Bowles leaned back to murmur to Tash, the old presenter's standby, classic. A chart that divided the population into four categories, by location on the planet's day or night side at the moment of the sun's disappearance, and by weather, sky-covered, sky-clear. As the Home Secretary had noted, Americans and others who, deep in the night, had had no direct evidence of the sun's loss barely seemed to have accepted the event at all. Not yet, anyhow. Under the day side, under a cloudy sky, the sudden darkness, as in Newcastle itself, had inflicted a deep shock, but one which seemed relatively manageable. But if you happened to be standing under a clear sky and you saw the sun's light vanish in a moment, the impact was much greater. There followed some discussion of the population's wider reaction so far. According to the reports, accidents, even fatalities, had been few. That was thanks partly to the smartness of the modern built environment, Tash saw. Just as smart cars had stopped when the light went, so had smart planes organised themselves to make safe landings at the nearest airports in orderly swarms, and so on. But still, there was the psychological shock that no smart technology could cushion. There had been the curiosity, maybe, that had drawn many people out of doors to see for themselves. Or, alternatively, the fear that had already prompted many to go home and hunker down, even to take their kids out of school. And the edginess that had caused many to go giddy, to dance and sing, drink and shoot up, even to party. Or start small riots, the police representatives reported now. In many places, even though so far the power had stayed on almost everywhere, people had lit bonfires as if to defy the dark. Fires that had predictably, in more than one place, got out of control. The doctors believed that even if the sun returned immediately, they would be dealing for many years with cases of mental trauma caused in that first instant. All this after only a couple of hours, Tash thought. After a few minutes of this, the Home Secretary wrapped it up. Okay, thank you. So the question is, how to go forward? We need more data. Astronomer Royal Marlowe put in immediately. Data has to be the basis of all scientific understanding, which must in turn guide public policy. And that's got to be an international effort. We must collect as much data as we can from Earth, from space, especially in these first hours. Share it all, of course, including records of the vanishing itself. Yes, yes. The Home Secretary nodded, a little impatiently. Agreed. But in practical terms, we must consider recommendations for the near future before leaving this room. The next 24 or 48 hours, the pace of the discussion quickened. Tash was, at first, reluctantly impressed by the detailed discussion that followed. But watching Fred Bowles, she saw he was growing increasingly restless, as was Charlie Marlowe. This was an unprecedented crisis. But the English government, like governments around the world, had over the years, or decades, learned how to cope with a stream of disasters unfolding on a world that was still hugely interconnected, hugely interdependent, and hugely vulnerable to such calamities as extreme weather events, pandemics, terrorist incidents. So this situation was new, yet old. And maybe the human world was a bit more resilient now. With deeper reserves of food and other essentials, shorter supply chains, less material connectivity, but with extreme connectivity of information, extra redundancy too. So what quickly emerged from this preliminary discussion was a series of steps that Tash thought were clear, sensible, probably acceptable to a public used to dire governmental warnings, and yet moderate, given that nobody knew how this was going to unfold in the next days or hours. For instance, schools. the Education Secretary advised a calm approach. Schools should expect to stay open today through the normal day, as at least some pupils were already on the premises. There could be chaos if all the schools peremptorily shut and parents had to scramble through the dark to pick them up. Today was Friday. Maybe they should plan now for schools to stay shut on Monday. Tash thought of Mel and her daughter, Jane. She promised herself that she would send a quick heads up to Mel about this after the meeting, even if it bent the security protocol a little. Hospitals. A spate of admissions had to be expected, through accidents in the sudden dark and the party time stuff going on in some cities. Longer term, mental health issues to do with the coming of the dark and its continuance. Police and health officials had agreed to move to public holiday protocols for now, as if New Year's Eve, just a few days back, had come again. The supply chain. Transport would be prioritised for essential goods and services and kept running as long as possible. Roads, rail, by air, by sea. For food and other essentials, there ought to be no immediate problem with supplies, save that people always panic bought at the first sign of any crisis, Tash knew, even in an age of app food. The Home Secretary hesitated about imposing immediate rationing. People would be encouraged to stay at home, save for essential workers. The power would be kept on for heating, lighting, as long as possible, with phased shutdowns if necessary. The Energy Minister warned of spikes in demand at a time when the supply was already stretched by the midwinter. Kane agreed to buy additional megawatts from abroad, including the huge Scottish wind power farm, New Aberdeen, on Dogger Island. There was some discussion of the royal family. Tash learned now that there was a pre-existing multi-agency group called RAVIC, the Royal and VIP Executive Control, tasked with the welfare of King George VII and the rest of the family in the face of contingencies like this. Anyhow, most of them were still holed up in Balmoral after the Christmas break, although Princess Charlotte, formerly Captain General of the Royal Marines and actually a serving officer, was with her unit in Wiltshire, and so on and so on. This was by far the most senior meeting Tash had yet attended as part of Bowles's staff, and she was impressed at how quickly a rough, if short-term, strategy was mapped out. Quickly, given the novelty of the situation, anyhow. These people were genuinely, conscientiously and intelligently trying to protect the population who had voted them, or their bosses, into power, and those who hadn't. Slowly, gradually, Tash felt herself reassured by the evident competence on show, until Charlie Marlowe spoke up. The meeting had already started winding down. The committee agreed to issue public advisories for now, and review the situation if the sun wasn't back by Monday. "Thank you all," Kane said. She looked around the table. "Of course this is only the beginning, but God knows we have learned to cope with catastrophe. I'm sure everybody here understands the importance of on-message speaking." Marlowe cut across the politician. "Oh, for... is that it? You aren't considering breaking up this meeting with that? This isn't enough. Debating whether to close the schools? The bloody royals? Is that really as far ahead as you can think? Then the Lord help us all. Because unless all this somehow resolves itself quickly, you will soon have to consider the longer term." Kane seemed weary, as if longing for the meeting to be over. "Professor, I think we have all..." But Fred Bowles, who Tash had noticed had been getting restless himself during the detailed discussions, leaned forward. "Very well, Charlie. Professor, what's the worst case? If, well, if this goes on?" "If the sun doesn't come back, you mean? If you can't bear to say it out loud, I will, and I'll try to answer the question. Look, I am no climatologist, and there should be some in this room, but it's going to get bloody cold," the Astronomer Royal said bluntly. "Well, you know that. The relevant questions are how cold and how long it will take to get that cold." She hefted her phone. "I've made some order of magnitude calculations while we've been sitting here, which would have been better with some online connectivity. Shoot me down if you know better, any of you." Silence around the table. Our environment, the environment of Earth that sustains every living thing, relies on sunlight, Marlowe said now. Around a third of the sunlight that hits the Earth is reflected away. The rest is taken into the great planetary systems, the flows of matter and energy that sustain the atmosphere, the oceans, the biosphere, before finally radiating back out as waste heat. And now that input has been turned off. The good news is we won't freeze immediately. The air will retain its heat for a while. There is still water vapour in the air. Well, water itself is a greenhouse gas. But today is Friday. By Sunday, Monday, the air will have cooled enough for the water to condense out. Rain first. Then snow, Bowles asked. Snow and frost. By the end of next week, the water vapour will all have gone from the air. When it's gone, it will get colder even faster. That evoked a few uneasy frowns, Tash thought. Then the sea will start to freeze. Just the surface at first. Before that happens, you see, the relatively warm winds off the seawater will have been moderating conditions on land. But once the ocean is frozen over, 2 weeks from now, there will be 100-degree frosts in Britain, for example. A month from now, and the seas will have frozen down to the equator. At that point, many of us should still be alive, actually. In industrial communities, at least, as long as the fuel lasts, as long as the machines don't seize up. Think small groups, isolated, huddling. But with the sea frozen, land temperatures will plummet. 2 months from now, the air will snow out, oxygen first. The whole Earth will head ultimately for the temperature of interstellar space. You ask about the worst case, Minister. In 60 days' time, it will be colder than Pluto. After a year, outside of maybe a handful of shelters covered with layers of frozen air, and maybe the denizens of the deepest seas, nothing will survive. A bewildered silence. 60 days, said Fred Bowles. Kane seemed horrified. As well she might, Tash thought. That's the beginning of March. Kane shook her head. It isn't some distant abstraction. March? We can't possibly take this to the full cabinet, let alone the fizz. Bowles said, relatively gently, I think we must, Home Secretary, and as soon as possible. Charlie, thank you. I'll need you during the international conference calls later. Marlowe glared at Kane. Home Secretary, what you do is up to you. The sooner you accept the reality, the sooner you will start making realistic preparations, the better. Oh, and even beyond that, we have to consider the implications that we now know we share a universe with an entity capable of such a huge and malicious act. In the meantime, I will try to get some useful work done. And her link from Skythrust fizzed out.